month, one for Dan, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money Summer Special Series. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute. If you're taking a break this summer, and I hope that you are, but you're still craving a political fix, then we are here to help, giving you the best of from the Australia Institute's popular Politics in the Pub and other live events from 2018. It's hard to believe, but in 2018, we've had yet another change in Prime Minister, a new minority government in the process, a fired up and expanded House of Representatives crossbench, but we've also seen off billions in lost revenue from the dumped company tax cuts, and a federal ICAC now looks inevitable. And joining the Australia Institute at our final Politics in the Pub for a look back at 2018 are Federal Press Gallery journalist Rob Harris, political reporter for the Herald Sun, Annika Smethurst, national political editor for the Sunday Telly, Herald Sun and Sunday Mail, Bevan Shields, the federal editor and Canberra bureau chief for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and Amy Remakis, federal reporter and live politics blog legend at Guardian Australia. Together, they were joined by Ben Oquist, executive director of the Australia Institute, to discuss 2018. What even was that?
Welcome to the end of year political wrap.
And just a quick note, there's some colourful language by the panellists at times, so just be aware if you're listening to this with little ones in the car.
Tonight we've got the privilege of being joined by a panel of four prominent Federal Press Gallery journalists, some of the top political journalists in the country. Rob Harris, political reporter at the Herald Sun. Annika Smethurst, the national political editor at the Sunday Telegraph, Herald Sun and Sunday Mail. Bevan Shields, a federal editor and Canberra bureau chief for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Amy Remakis, federal political reporter and live blog legend at Guardian Australia. So 2018, what a year. Can you believe it? We've had a new Prime Minister this year. I know that seems very old hat. We've had a signature economic policy and a company tax cut defeated. We've done all sorts of work and engagement in politics, but so have you. And one of the things I want to talk about here tonight is how important politics is, but how we need a better politics. One of the ways of having a better politics is having an engaged and informed community. So it's why we love putting on Politics in the Pub, and it's why we, in particular, like this session at the end of the year that looks back, that has some of the finest minds who are engaging and observing politics to interact with you and explore some of those ways that politics has gone wrong, but maybe sometimes how politics has gone right. Because in the end, if you believe in democracy, you believe in politics. It's how we make decisions without killing each other. It's how we organise our society without having to resort to violence. So it is important. But for it to work, we've got to be engaged. And there's a responsibility on all of us too to be engaged and informed and participate. So thanks for coming along tonight. But in particular, thanks to our panel, who's taken time out of a busy schedule. But I wanted to start by asking each of our panellists, what's wrong with politics? If there's something in particular that struck you as a let's start negative as a low light of the year, please let us know. I might start with you, Bevan, if that's all right.
Look, it's a big question. I think one of the, and it's only one problem, one of the problems is I think that Parliament doesn't look like us. You know, when you actually look at who's sitting in the Parliament, and this is an issue for both, all sides of politics, it doesn't represent us. It doesn't look like us. So, you know, it's filled with lawyers, it's filled with former staffers, increasingly former staffers, it's filled with union officials, and it lacks women particularly, and that's a big problem. You know, like, as an example, the Liberal Party after the election, when you look at, you know, who's retiring, who's in the firing line in marginal seats, and sort of do some calculations. If the result's pretty bad for them next year, the Liberal Party could maybe have 3 or 4 women left in the whole of the House of Representatives. Now, that on what planet is that acceptable, and on what planet does that sort of deliver an outcome when, you know, our representatives aren't reflective of, you know, our hopes and ambitions and fears? And I think that's one, I mean, that's, it's a big question, but I think that's a big issue. And it's also actually something that is within the reach of the politicians and the parties to actually fix.
Yeah, maybe politics has got so bad it's a bit hard to say one thing that's wrong with it, so we might have a long list by the end of tonight. Annika, you got a particular take?
I think Bevan stole my answer in many ways, but I actually think further than just the representation, which isn't reflective of necessarily all of us, it's the bullying and the... often it's at females, but it's not just at females, but the acceptable nature that we think this is okay. And I fall for it too, and I know we all do. We all sort of go, well, that's just Canberra, and, you know, you've got to be tough to make it. And there was a lot of that language around with Julia Banks. She was a good example. You know, she is somebody that has done so well in her private life. She's the daughter of 2 migrants. She moved here only speaking Greek. She rose through the ranks and she became an executive and a lawyer, and she's done so much. She wanted to join the Liberal Party to make change through an avenue she thought she could do it. She didn't just throw her toys out of the cot. She gave them warning, and she wasn't happy with the way things were going. She feels she had no choice but to leave. And I think so often we do it in the press gallery too, that, you know, we sort of wear it as a badge of honour, like, you should work these outrageous hours, you should work late and you should live it, and, you know, you shouldn't have a day off. And it's a really terrible culture up there, and I think it should be for the best and brightest, but I think we make so many excuses and excuse so much terrible behaviour through that. So I think that plays to the women thing too, that, you know, there's not a lot of... it's not the perfect environment, I guess, in which to... I'm not pro-quotas, which is something interesting that a lot of people are calling for. I think it's about making the environment right so people feel like they want to work there, and at the moment they're just not achieving that.
Rob, you got any reflections on that? Take your own take, of course, but is there something wrong with the very culture and nature of federal politics that's worse or different?
Look, I should have thought through this question harder. I knew it was coming. So, look, I don't completely know if politics is bad. I mean, I think we're going through a bad period. I'll certainly admit that. I think this government has just been shambolic the last few months, if not a little bit longer. But I think it'll change. And I think we do go through peaks and troughs. There have been many periods in our history where we've had shambolic leadership changes regularly, perhaps not as regularly as it used to be. But, you know, there are periods. And I do think, I would suspect, and I probably hope, just in terms of the future of the country, that we're probably going to end this period very shortly. You would expect. I think probably, I mean, the government's major flaw is the fact that they'd seen this movie before and they hadn't learned, you know. You know, there are so many parallels between what's happened in this government compared to the 6 years of Rudd, Gillard Rudd, as they like to say. Clearly, they haven't learnt their lessons, and they're going to pay a massive price for it, unless, you know, barring some sort of outside event. And I think I'd struggle to think even that would change it. Labor are probably heading towards 100 seats, so a big majority. Someone said to me the other day, and they compared, you know, the Gillard Rudd era to the Whitlam era, where they got a few things right, they got a few things wrong, and that they hope the Shorten era will be more like a Hawke Keating era, where they can learn from the mistakes. Be stable, reasonably stable, and be in power for a long time. So, you know, clearly there is a culture. I think that's widely addressed now. I don't know how we get more women into Parliament. I mean, especially in the Liberal Party.
Pre-select them for a start.
Well, pre-select them, exactly. Yeah, pre-select them for a start. One of them said to me the other day, a woman who's... She's lost her pre-selection, but she's been in Parliament for a long time. She also said that she'd never not been challenged at pre-selection over 15 or 20 years. So perhaps that maybe if you do pre-select a woman, don't challenge their pre-selection 3 years later. So that's a problem. But that's a problem they have to work out themselves, I guess. I mean, you'd expect they will. It might take a while. So I'm more upbeat. I don't think politics is all too bad. We've had a bad period, but I think it might be about to turn the corner.
Amy, what's wrong?
And I just have to say, for anyone who hasn't seen the news, Theresa May's just had a no-confidence motion passed on her. So it's not just us who have these issues. I think it's everything that these guys have said, and they've been doing this a lot longer than I have, so they've witnessed a lot more than I have from a federal level. I think a big problem in Australian politics, though, is when our politicians decided to import personality politics and place it in the Westminster system. I mean, one of the saving graces of Australian politics has been compulsory voting, because there's a huge group of people in the middle. Yeah, you should applaud it. It saved you from, like, a Brexit-like situation or a Trump. There's a huge group of people in the middle who don't care about politics beyond their daily lives, and it means that the political parties don't have to go out to the extremes to convince people to vote. It's one of the strengths of the Australian system. But what they've done, particularly around the Abbott, Kevin Rudd era, was they decided to make the leader's personality a thing, and political parties have risen and fallen with the popularity of the leader. So we saw that with Kevin Rudd, we saw that happen with Tony Abbott, we saw it happen with Malcolm Turnbull, we saw it happen with Julia Gillard, and now Scott Morrison has inherited this, and he's again trying personality politics with just the, you know, I'm just like you, the average bloke who's still paying off my mortgage despite earning $370,000-something for the past 6 years. He's trying it again, and I think that people are really fatigued of that. Like, voters are very fatigued. They want policy, they want consistency, they want their government to make the hard decisions, even if it's not necessarily popular. And I think one of the problems is that we have relied... as a society, have relied on the popularity of the leader in opinion polls and all the rest of it, and political parties have gotten a bit antsy and started paying attention to that stuff.
I also think, you know, I look back at every Prime Minister that's been deposed, and everything you said is right, but none of them have been very good leaders. And I think clearly there's a lack of leadership and a lack of someone who is aware of how his party room feels. You know, you could point to every example from Rudd, Gillard, Abbott and Turnbull where they ignored large swathes of the party room, trusted the wrong people, promoted the wrong people, didn't trust their instincts and went what they thought was right, you know, like, or what they were told they should do. So I perhaps, you know, lack of leadership is what's wrong with our politics right now, Ben.
Mm. Let's get into one side of politics to start with, which is a nice segue into what's going wrong with the Liberal Party and what's the prognosis. We've just heard from Rob that maybe 100 seats for Labor at the next election would be a thumping win. Bevan, I was struck by something you wrote a couple of weeks ago when looking back at a bad week for the Liberal Party, and that people were being quoted as saying that in the Liberals that maybe what they really need is a good clean out and a good period in opposition, and that's what would be good for them. And these are people in the Liberal Party. Do they really think that? Do they really want to lose?
The people saying that do, because they're the ones that will survive. but I think it's true. But you know, Rob's probably right about a lot can change, and it's tricky putting numbers on it. But that's what they're looking at, and I don't think people really got that until about 8 p.m. on election night in Victoria, and they realise, oh my God, you know, like, we are going to be absolutely slaughtered. And there's no better example that a period in opposition can actually be really good for you than Labor. I mean, they're an absolute catastrophe and a rabble at the end of 2013. And look where they are now. You know, they have learnt the lessons. We'll see if they stick with that in government. So, I mean, I think their biggest problem now is you can't write them off, but they're looking pretty bad. But barely anyone in the government thinks that they're going to win. And that's actually a really dangerous situation for them to be in, because if that one motivator of actually pulling the show together, getting their shit together, you know, is another term in government, and nobody thinks that they're going to have another term in government, then it's a really bad situation for them to be in, because they're just going to be wild. You know, if they know there's no victory at the end of it, they're going to do some really crazy stuff, and they're not going to pull together. crazier.
Yeah.
I was like, where's the baseline?
They nearly appointed Peter Dutton leader, Bevan, so...
Where do they go, and how crazy do they get? Annika, you wrote recently, and broke that story about how they might go back to Barnaby Joyce for the Nationals at least, and that's why it did seem amusing to many people, given the catastrophe he seemed to have caused not just the Nationals but the government. Is that possible? We go back to Barnaby Joyce on their side, or even Tony Abbott?
It seemed incredible to me when somebody rang me on a Saturday morning and said, oh, I think Barnaby's, up and about. I thought, surely not, he should know that it's not even been a year. It's been a few months. His baby hasn't had its first birthday. Like, let's just calm down a bit. But the idea within the Nationals is that if the Liberals are going well and the Liberals have a good leader, they can just coast and go off their coattails. But when they see the Liberals in such a disaster that they are now, that they've got to stand up for themselves. And whilst Michael McCormack might be everything that Barnaby Joyce isn't, he's been with the same woman since he was 16, he's a teetotaler, he's all these sort of things, they feel that in many ways he's not fighting for them. And understandably, you can imagine the Nationals want to distance themselves from the Liberal Party at the moment, because the Liberal Party are responsible for, a lot of the disasters and rolling a leader. And so their thought is, well, when they're not doing well, we need the strongest leader we can. It's incredible that they think that Barnaby Joyce would be that answer. There's still so many people within the National Party that think that when Malcolm Turnbull went out and criticised him, that he was, letting, the bro code down or something, which is outrageous, because everyone knew that might be acceptable or not acceptable, but understood in Canberra circles. But most people out there thought what he did was wrong. We all understand it. We know this goes on. But nobody thought that he could continue to be Deputy Prime Minister when he's done what he's done. And Malcolm Turnbull, and, he never repaired that relationship with Barnaby Joyce. But in the eyes, I would say, of most voters, I don't think they're quite ready yet. There are people that will love Barnaby no matter what they do, and it's the same with Pauline Hanson. She could do anything, and there are rusted-on voters that will like them. But as Amy said, we have compulsory voting, and you do actually have to woo the middle. And the two parties might see themselves as different, the Liberal and Nationals, but in terms of voters, when they go into there, they often vote coalition. We don't have a lot of three-way contests. So when they vote for the Liberal or National Party and they think they're getting Barnaby Joyce as Deputy Prime Minister, I think that'll hurt. But there is still a strong view out there that perhaps that's what they need, and it's kind of incredible that that's where they're at.
And Tony Abbott. People think Tony Abbott are the answer after...
And because he's the only... he won government off a Labor MP. Whether that's right or not, he won the coalition government off Labor, and there are people out there that whenever you write about him, they will email you and remind you of that fact, and always have that. So,
Scott Morrison, where's he gone wrong, and how could he pull it back? Is his switch to national security and boats a winner for him that can turn it around? Is there a great surplus that he can spend that can turn it around? What's his best hope, and do you give it any?
I don't know. Is anyone even listening anymore to politics? Like, it's literally, is there anything Scott Morrison could do to change your mind about this government? And, I mean, that's the problem that the government is having. People switched off. Like, they have literally switched off. And it doesn't matter how many buses Scott Morrison has drive up the coast of Queensland. It doesn't matter how many sausages he smashes into his face, or
pies.
How much... Yeah. Or, Spotify playlists that he puts out, or talking about Sri Lankan curries. It doesn't matter, because people have switched off. And in terms of the surplus and things, I think people are looking at that quite cynically and just sort of going, well, you think you're going to buy my vote, but I'm not sure that's going to work, because there has been quite a lot of cuts and there has been quite a lot of things that have been put off, so people can kind of recognise pork barrelling for what it is. And then there's the whole issue of whether people even know Scott Morrison. I mean, he's doing a really, really good job of trying to present an image of himself, But whether that is enough to turn around the government's fortunes, I don't know, because then you've still got Craig Kelly and you still have Tony Abbott and you still have Barnaby Joyce. You still have people trying to name the treasurer. It's Josh Frydenberg, for anyone who doesn't know. He's great on social media. You've got, as Annika was pointing out, the problems with Michael McCormack. If you put his face on a core flute in many national communities, you'd have people going, who the hell is that? You might as well have white bread on a picture there. It would be as effective. So I am not sure there is anything that Scott Morrison can do. And I think Rob's point, that outside event, is why we're hearing a lot about national security, because it's one of the things that the Liberals feel like that they're stronger on, national security and border protection and all the rest. But I think the public has grown since Tampa, and I don't think that even a catastrophe like that would be enough to save, and I mean that in the most horrifying, cynical way possible, this government, because I think people are aware that when it comes to that sort of stuff, there's not a huge amount of difference between the two political parties, which is another issue in itself. But there's not. So no, I don't think that there is a lot that can turn this government around. They seem to think so, but when you look at the numbers, there's been a boundary redistribution. Labor is already ahead by 2 or 3, depending on how you look at it. They've got a new seat in ACT, they've got movement in South Australia, you've got movement in Victoria. So where do the Liberals pick up the seats? Where do they win seats? And every single LNP MP I ask that question of doesn't have an answer.
Last week, I don't know if anyone saw Scott Morrison's press conference last week, but it was a little bit over the top and hysterical. clearly, I mean, he's eating into his national security brand equity, so to speak. And it looked desperate. And in many sense, you know, when it's happening, this is a red-hot political issue. But they're going to be, they're a victim of their own success, right? Because they've been successful there, votes aren't coming, and I think when you continue to play on it, it risks sort of breeding cynicism into that issue, but also every other issue as well. So, during the Victorian campaign, there was a terror attack in the middle of Melbourne. It certainly didn't, you know, and the Liberals down there were very hard lines on sort of law and order and etc. I don't think that harmed Dan Andrews at all, clearly. Look, I'm sure they'll pivot to it. There are twice as many people within the party now that were deeply uncomfortable with the way Scott Morrison behaved last week because they think it was tone deaf and that people aren't listening. And I think particularly they've got to, you know, clearly since the spill and since the Julia Banks incidents, they've got a real problem with female voters.
I wanted to ask you about that, Robert, because, you know, they've switched to boats as though it's somehow a positive for them.
Yeah.
But it struck me that, you know, you broke that story a while back, well, not too far back, about Libs on the backbench agitating to get children off Nauru and wanting a more compassionate policy. Yet all of a sudden we seem to have... That was a backbench revolt, seeming a shift in position inside the government, and now we've switched to, no, they're back on the attack on boats again. What's going on?
Well, I think it's a pivot to what they know has worked in the past, really, and nothing more. It's a sort of a natural reflex, almost.
It wasn't a sucker punch to get the Labor to move, and then they can move back in?
Look, I don't think so. Look, the one thing I do want to say here is that we've spoken about how bad the government has been, and there's a reason they've been so bad is that because Labor have actually been so good for so long. And the big mistake, when Tony Abbott rolled Malcolm Turnbull and they were so disciplined and hammered away at Rudd and Gillard, they didn't have the fight on... They were so disciplined, they didn't have an internal fight on what it meant to be a Liberal, and they're now having it in government, and it's fallen away. But where Bill Shorten has, whether you like him or loathe him, and there'll be people in the room in both camps... you know, they have run rings around them on policy. They have put pressure on them at every opportunity to the point where, you know, they're panicked. You know, they panicked over a Royal Commission. They've panicked on so many things because Labor have actually, you know, got their shopper in order relatively quickly after losing government, but they've had big fights internally, you know. They had a big fight over trade, but... and Bill was able to spin that as that's a positive thing, and we've landed on our positive... policy, and everyone's had the opportunity, and he has not you know, not let his foot off the throat of any leader, and that is the reason the government's falling to pieces. So we should probably praise Labor for the way they behaved in opposition, because they've been formidable.
Absolutely.
I mean, God, we're really sort of smashing them, and they probably deserve it. But I think some people in the government think our one chance to pull this back would be the budget, and there is an enormous amount of money flowing into the budget at the moment, and they're going to shove that down your throats. And you know, there'll be surplus to push. You know, there'll be stuff in the budget at the moment. Part of their problem is like what do they have? I mean, what are their big vision policies? They've got nothing. So that's why I'm a bit sceptical about a March election, because I think they really need the weight of a budget to be able to then go through into a campaign. And I think that might be the one. I mean, I just need to be a bit cautious, because, as I said, there is so much money, and it's a horrible truth, but
they,
people will like money.
They will, but, I mean, further to both those points, I mean, Labor has been acting as a government in opposition when the government has been acting as an opposition in government, and they are under siege, and you feel it. And what Rob was saying about Labor having their shit together, it's absolutely true. There's a conference on Saturday where there's going to be, you know, fights over industrial relations policy, there's going to be fights over refugees, there's going to be fights over new starts, there's going to be fights over a stupid nuclear treaty. And I mean, it's stupid, I just mean like in terms of, you know, the fight that they're having. But Bill Shorten has been able to tell the public that it's good that we have debates. It's good that we have these fights and that we work it out as a party, because then we present this issue to you as a united force. And that is what they have been doing. And while the government does have a shit ton of cash coming your way, Labor has had policies in place since before the last election which they've stuck to and they've added to. And the most recent example of the government panicking over that was today, when they announced $1.25 billion in health spending, which is basically a copy of a Labor policy which was $2.8 billion, but over further amount of years. Like, they're just having to match Labor on absolutely everything. Labor just drags them to the line, says, you should be doing this, we're going to do it. The government does it, Labor moves on to a new issue. And we've seen that again and again and again. And I just can't see the government managing to overcome that.
I don't think they can win, but I think the best chance they've got is the economy. Labor are going to introduce a lot of taxes, whether it's franking credits or anything else, and people hate money being taken out of the pocket. So that's their strongest avenue to win. I also think Scott Morrison's language has been really interesting on money. So I sat down with him, I think, last week, the G20, and he talked about previous Liberal governments using the economy as a trophy. So we're going to take all this money and we're going to have cuts everywhere and we're going to bring you into surplus, but we're not going to give you anything back. And he said it was a huge mistake because, you know, it might look good in boardrooms or at KPMG when you get the books back, but people don't care. They want services. So he is really trying to frame it, and it won't probably be enough to save him, but we're going to get the books back in. Like, the best job he did was as treasurer. He was quiet and just worked really hard. And if he manages to convince people that we're getting, you know, everything in order and the books back in order to give you health and education, because they're so scared of a Medicare-style campaign again, that they're going to really prop up education and health, I think that's the best bet they've got. That saying that we're not just saving money for the sake of it to look good, we're actually going to save it to give you guys more. And they won't get there, but it should be saving seats that they perhaps would lose if they don't do that.
Before we go to questions from you, I'm going to ask the panel if they've got a quick highlight and low light from the year they'd like to share, and then we'll get into questions from you. Well, let's go left to right.
Highlight and low light is probably the spill. I mean, it was the... You know, you can make an argument for every other spill that's probably happened. You know, the public sort of understood. Well, maybe they didn't understand the first Rudd one. That wasn't really explained, and that paid them. But I think the August spill against Malcolm Turnbull was just totally ridiculous. I mean, they understood why, because clearly the party room didn't like him. But I think they're going to pay a lot for it, because voters voters might not have liked Malcolm, but I don't think they hated him at the same sort of passion as they hated an Abbott or whatnot. And I spoke to a very senior union leader from Victoria who is in charge of a lot of campaigning, and he rang me up and he was in hysterics because he said, they've got no idea. Malcolm was actually holding up the Liberal vote in Victoria. In fact, Malcolm was more powerful than the Liberal brand, and our whole strategy was to attack Malcolm because that was the only chance we had of really beating them here, and they've just got rid of their greatest asset. And I think it was bizarre when you looked at those people, Greg Hunt, Alan Tudge, Jason Wood in Victoria, Michael Suka, Michael Kroger, those people wanted Peter Dutton as leader, and I would suggest, had Peter Dutton been leader, there wouldn't have been too many Liberals left in Victorian Parliament, left. That was a highlight, just because of how wacky it was. It was probably the low light too, because I just thought, we really have, the self-interest of a few, and the fact that they couldn't even count. They didn't even have the numbers.
The finance minister couldn't count.
They just took out the baseball bat and bludgeoned them to death. Actually, the highlight, a little anecdote. Malcolm Turnbull was once involved with, trying with Conrad Black to buy The Age. And was it the Age? Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm famously said to Conrad Black, Conrad, if you want to be an assassin, you've got to get blood on your hands. And Malcolm actually quoted that to one of his colleagues moments before he went out and said, all right, you can bring on this spill, but I want every one of you to sign that letter. 43 signatures. And I think one by one, he's got a little list like that girl in Game of Thrones. And he's going to hunt them down one by one. So I thought that was a genius. And I think at the time, even people within the Liberal Party room were saying, where was this Malcolm for the past 6 months? He outmanoeuvred them, but it was only for a little glimpse, but then it all came down to an end. So, yeah, that was probably my highlight. My lowlight was just the entire spill, really. I didn't even mention Barnaby Joyce. I might leave that for others.
God, it's been quite the year. I think I can do my highlight and lowlight in one take too, and that would be the it's okay to be white clusterfuck that happened in the Senate and in the Parliament. Just an absolute terrible, terrible moment for the Australian Parliament to have a senator stand up there, and he knew what he was saying. Fraser Anning knew what he was saying, and he knew it would get the reaction that it did. And I was probably, I mean, it's my job to watch the Senate, unfortunately, at all times. And I heard him say it, and I went, no, he didn't even go that far. And so I rewound and I listened to it again, and then I made everyone in the office listen to it. And then I grabbed some poor random ABC people who were, because our office faces the toilet, so anyone who went past the toilet, I was like, did he just say this? And grabbed them. And then I started calling every single politician in my phone going, do you know what just happened in the Senate? And nobody knows what's happening in the Senate because it's the Senate. So it didn't make a huge splash, and I had a bit of a meltdown, and then Tony Burke stood up in the House and he was like, we need to draw a line. And the next day we saw the Parliament come together as a whole and say, this is too far. And everybody, except for, David Lynehelm, condemned it. And there's a reason for that, because we have seen politics descend into just utter, utter despair this year. We've seen the attacks grow. You've seen Sarah Hanson-Young, like what happened with her. You've seen the Senate actually have to change the rules to stop these sorts of attacks. You've seen what happened during the marriage equality debate, the religious freedoms debate. It's not going to be any better. You just saw them keep moving the line. And so to actually have your parliament realise that they had moved the line so far that they now had senators talking about genocide and the Holocaust and quoting Nazis in terms of what we needed to do with our immigration, to have them all collectively go, actually, we need to, wind this back. I mean, I'm sorry that it took for that to get them to the line, but I'm glad that it did, that something happened that made them all wake up to this rhetoric about what they were talking about in terms of immigration, what they were talking about in terms of African gangs, how they were referring to certain parts of our community, how that actually made them go, we have facilitated this and we need to stop. And that was probably the highlight for me.
It's always bad when, you know, the moment you sort of invoke the Nazi...
Yeah, you've gone too far. You've lost the argument.
I think the low light for me was in the last Thursday of August. So it was Malcolm... There'd been the first spill against Malcolm on the Tuesday, and he'd survived that, and then they were determined to knock him off, and the wheels were falling off on Thursday. They were, you know, the petition was going around. It was just dreadful. It was getting to about 11:30, and everyone thought, wow, geez, question time's going to be fantastic, isn't it? And they went in and they voted to shut down Parliament, which I just think, like, that was, to me, that was the moment where I thought, you know what, you don't deserve to win. Like, if you need to shut down Parliament to deal with your garbage, you know, like, it's pretty well over. And I just thought that was an absolute disgrace. The highlight, I kind of screenshotted. It's like a funny moment, so just bear with me. And it's not as good as the real deal. But during the Commonwealth Games, Malcolm Turnbull was, you know, in the audience, and they were singing "You're the Voice," you know, John Farnham, "You're the Voice." And the camera went on Malcolm Turnbull, and he clearly did not know the words. And so anyway, so everyone, like, that was like, oh, isn't that funny, for a couple of days. And then Turnbull went on Neil Mitchell, who's one of the best interviewers in the country. And it got to the very end of this interview, and then Neil Mitchell said, "Oh, you sure you don't want to recite the words to 'You're the Voice,' do you?" And clearly Malcolm's officers said, "Malcolm, you need to be ready for the 'You're the Voice' question next time you get it." And he absolutely stuffed it. And he said, "Well, there's a good line in there for the treasurer. Time to, cripes. Time to, there's a bit about balancing the books." And Neil Mitchell goes, "It's not the bit about looking down the barrel of a gun, is it?" And Turnbull goes, no, sons and daughters, no, there's a good line in there for the treasurer. Oh, I've lost it." And Neil Mitchell sort of says, "All right, we'll see you later, thanks." And it was just so funny. And it spoke volumes about, like, just be authentic. And that moment, I thought, like, for Malcolm, you know, like, there's all these questions about, was he the real Malcolm when he was PM and all that sort of stuff. Like, that was just a great, I mean, it was hilarious, but it also had a bigger message to me about authenticity. Anyway, if you find it, you should go home, and if you've got no life, go home and YouTube it, and it's very funny.
Bevan will tweet it later.
My low light, I'll start, end with the highest, we'll start with the low light, was the treatment of women. And I'm 31. I've never even considered myself a feminist for no reason than I've never had to. I was born in 87. I never thought women couldn't do something. I was never told women couldn't do anything men did. I wasn't born in 1920. It wasn't until I got to Parliament that I went, God, women are treated terribly around here. And it is. They are genuinely treated worse. And, you know, you can have so many examples. I'm not saying there aren't men out there that are treated worse, but whether it's the way Barnaby Joyce spoke about his partner, that there was a grey area over the paternity, or and thought that that was all right, and, you know, or whether it was Barry O'Sullivan or Sarah Hanson-Young, it doesn't matter. There seems to be like this, we will treat you differently, and I've never seen, there's a lot of men that act poorly and they don't seem to get the personal attacks in Parliament. And it just drives me insane, because we talk about getting more women into Parliament. That is why. Because why would you do it when you can go be a lawyer or have a really successful career where you're respected and there's flexible work hours and people treat you properly? Why on earth would you go and try and have a debate about something when Barry O'Sullivan's there implying, you know, things about your sex life? Why would you do it?
He'll be gone in July.
He will be. My highlight is actually something which isn't that... It's not exactly shining Parliament in a great light, but it was the funniest moment of the year. It was when Melissa Price, who probably shouldn't have even been on the front bench, but they'd run out of people. She'd had a ministry like a week, and she just thought, I'm in a Canberra restaurant. That guy, I think he's like a former head of Kiribati. I'm going to go offend him. Like, if I just thought, that was when I thought the government is cooked. You can't even go out.
He said, it's, oh, you're from the Pacific.
You're here for
it's,
some cash.
You want some cash. It's always about the cash with you people.
And it's like, this woman has made it to the front bench, and there'd been a lot of talk for her for a while, you know, which women should rise up. A lot of people had been sort of advocating for her. She gets her chance, and within 2 weeks she just couldn't resist the temptation after a pizza on the Kingston foreshore to go and offend this guy.
Yeah, and then, as if you wouldn't go, can you not let her talk? About 2 weeks after that, the big intergovernmental panel on climate change report came out, and she clearly had a couple of days to sort of get her head around it, so she thought it would be a good idea to go on Radio National.
And it was terrible.
And it was dreadful, and they said, and she willingly she willingly offered. Oh, I haven't read it. Like, I haven't read the whole thing. Like, you're just the environment minister. You probably want to read.
And I just anyway, think there'd be so many people gunning for a spot in the front bench that wouldn't do that within the first fortnight. And anyway, it was just that was when I thought, oh, this place is cooked.
Looking forward to hearing a bit more from Melissa from Poland, but.
I didn't even mention Greg Hunt screaming at a 71-year-old grandmother, which is also a great...
He at least apologised. Different. He knew he'd done wrong and he apologised. Melissa doubled down.
There is a reason, though, why they call him Yorick on the Labour, because if you put it Yorick Hunt together... This is what you pick up in question time,
there's
ladies.
There's a
gentlemen.
Great story about that, is all the men call him Yorick, and then Jenny Macklin heard it and said, good on you, Yorick. And everyone said, looked at Jenny Macklin and said, do you know what it means? She goes, no, it's just they all say it. Well, it had to be explained to her, and she was horrified.
I'm from the Gold Coast. I knew exactly what that meant.
Well, questions. Has anybody got any burning questions? Got one down the back there in the middle. Anna, if we can start there.
You said some interesting things about Bill Shorten and about everybody on the other side. And all this year, Shorten has been not preferred to whoever. I can't remember about Tony Abbott, but I suspect he was never preferred to Tony Abbott either. Why is that? What's the reason? Because apparently if you look at all the statistics, all the history, preferred prime minister doesn't in fact mean anything about... actually winning. So, why is Bill not preferred when, as you said, he's doing a pretty good job of keeping them together, and everybody on government hasn't. And what does that mean, if anything? The other question is kind of related, because on last Thursday, something happened with an encryption bill, which, you know, nobody except the techies understand, but everybody understands that Labor apparently threw us under the bus. So my question is that strategic? Was it Labor, you know, throwing in the towel as they always do and disappointing us, whatever? Or is it why be a large target? Why not be a small target and let it get passed and we'll fix it later?
I'll go to the Bill. First. Yes. opposition leaders traditionally not preferred because they are basically whingers and complainers. I mean, that's part of being an opposition leader. You have to attack the government at every stage. You have to criticise. And I think, you know, the majority of the grabs that people see on the news or interviews you see, you're being critical and being grumpy and being aggressive some of the time. And I think that's, you know, clearly what hurts Bill Shorten. Most people only ever see Bill Shorten in the phase of he's criticising, he's whinging, he's, you know, attacking the government. And that changes. You know, when you become a prime minister, you're not always seen through that. You get to do good things, you get to do big things. You don't get to do that when you're opposition leader. And I think that's probably a large contributor to his polling.
I think he's very managed too. We're in the unique position to see these people in front of camera and often privately. And I think Bill is one of the people that is the most different privately. I'm not saying that he's got this whole other personality, but he is a very managed MP, and that's testament to the fact he's got there and his office, and he rarely puts publicly a foot wrong. The worst thing he can be accused of is, like, dad jokes and, you know, taking off earphones that aren't actually on and things like that. He's not off the leash enough to, I guess, in some ways that helps him because he's not off the leash enough to build a personality that you might like, but he's also not off the leash enough to make a mistake. So he's a very managed unit and very disciplined. And I think that'll be good and bad when he becomes Prime Minister. If he does, you'll see a different side to him, or you'll, you know, not like him for what he is. But you're just not seeing a full range as you are when you're seeing Scott Morrison on 9 interviews a day.
And you can see that, and he doesn't do a lot of sit-down interviews. You don't see a lot of one-on-one interviews.
He's on Bolt tonight, apparently.
Yeah, he goes on FM radio, and he does, like, a lot of radio, but he's not sitting down with, like, you know, Annika or Rob or, you know, Bevan's team or, you know, or us. And he certainly doesn't do a lot of one-on-one TV interviews. He did choose to do Andrew Bolt this evening, though. So, you know, he's in election mode, that's for sure. But it is exactly that reason. He's very managed, and it's for a reason. They want you to concentrate on Labor policy, not on Labor's leader.
You got a take on encryption and the the second question there about what privately that was from Labor might mean.
That's interesting you said that, because there was a lot of people in the Labor Party Thursday night that didn't know that reversal was coming, and they're furious about it, and they still thought that they needed to hold out and get some of the safeguards in there. I think Bill Shorten was scared that there would be a terror attack over summer and that he'd be blamed for it, and that's as simple as it is. Winding it back now, I don't think they have a hope in hell unless they become, you know, the government post-May. But getting amendments later on, they won't. But I think it was purely out of fear that opposition know that their weak point is security and national security, and should have anything happened, that question would have been raised.
Yeah, they really... I think for as well-managed and disciplined as they are, I think they probably got... They were looking at the prize too much last Friday when they were so hopeful to force, you know, a winning vote through the House. It would have been the first time the government had lost a vote like that since the Stanley Bruce, I think, in the late 1920s. And, you know, they wanted that win so badly where, you know, in retrospect, they could have actually just spent that time getting this encryption bill amended. Annika's dead right. And, you know, the thing we forget, and a lot of people will have ideological, you know, reasons why they don't like the encryption and whatnot, but the thing we do forget is, you know, a lot of those people are briefed by agencies. You know, there were lots of amendments that Labor wanted to get through, but, you know, when you have ASIO, when you have the AFP, when you have Victoria Police in Bill's home state saying we need elements of this law, I don't think Bill Shorten was prepared to walk away over Christmas and not let that through. They hope they can amend it in the new year. It has upset some people in Labor who really wanted to make sure they fixed the laws first before they got it passed. And the government was pretty crude on its negotiations as well. I think they really, you know, that committee has worked on a lot of national security legislation over the past 6 years, and they, you know, they land on a pretty much bipartisan spot every time. And you know, Tony Abbott, to his credit, did, and Malcolm Turnbull did. I really think this government was quite crude in the fact that they really tried to wedge Labor on a lot of things. Clearly they were worried about it, but I don't think Bill was walking away without getting that done.
I was going to ask how much responsibility that the media should take for personality politics, especially in terms of the preferred Prime Minister poll, because I've never understood, we don't elect the Prime Minister, so it's really misleading to people.
I think there's a lot of soul-searching to be done out of the end of this year for the media. On the preferred PM thing, I mean, we poll monthly through Ipsos, and I don't think we've ever started a story saying XYZ is preferred PM, because, I mean, it's just stupid. Like, Tony Abbott was well behind on preferred PM and approval ratings, and we know what... he won. So I don't like that. We don't do that. On the media front, I think the August leadership spill was really... a telling moment for not all. Like, it's too easy to just say all the media. It's not all the media. Some people in the media were absolutely played in August and absolutely bought the line that they had the numbers, and then it starts to snowball. And probably even worse than being played, some people were participants, and that's something that Malcolm rightly, I think, raised when he had his spray in his final press conference, that there were people that were active participants, actively engaged in trying to bring him down. I hate that, because I think media should be criticised, but I hate hearing generally, oh, the media XYZ, because there are a lot of people in the press gallery who are, like, including these three, do an absolutely fantastic job. People of integrity, people who just want to report on what's going on. And that's why I've really, you know, quite deflated really about what happened in August, because I think that actually did enormous damage to media as an industry.
I just can't get past, though, and I understand there were people... Alan Jones should not be ringing, and he admitted it. They should not be ringing around if you're a member. He claims he's not a journalist, and that's why he can do it. I don't think people should be ringing around advocating. But I also think we elect these people not to listen and be hoodwinked by Alan Jones. Like, they should make their own decisions, and they should consume everything. They should read as much sort of left and right media and talk to everyone in their electorate. And even though they're there for the Liberal Party or the Labor Party, you know, they should be critical thinkers. And to go, you know, oh, the media convinced these people to do it, if you're elected to Parliament to represent, you know, more than 100,000 people and you can't walk in a party room without being scared of what Ray Hadley might say tomorrow, you shouldn't be there. Like, I just...
Yeah, Malcolm, sorry, I know we're running short of time. Malcolm actually really identified the problem, that in a way it's not actually the influence of that commentator over the MP, it's the influence of that commentator over branch members, the people who pre-select these people and you know, they live or die based on the branch members who pre-select them. And Malcolm said that somebody had said to him something along the lines of, every time Sky News after 6 p.m. is going, it's like, you know, they're preaching or whatever to... It's like they're having a branch meeting with the branch members, and that's where the pressure comes. So you're right, the MP shouldn't bow to the commentator, but it's more complex than that, in that they, you know, those commentators are going for a very niche part of the community, and then that has a flow-on effect for politics.
On the Thursday before the leadership spill, Peter Dutton went on Ray Hadley, as he is wont to do, and Ray Hadley pretty much gave him instructions to challenge for the leadership. It was such an extraordinary conversation that I ended up, like, forcing myself to listen to the whole thing and transcribe it all for the blog, because it was literally, you need to challenge, here are the instructions to do it. And from that moment, it was on, because as Annika and Bevan have pointed to, like, they do listen to these people either through the branch or either through, you know, the fear that these people are going to destroy them. And the issue with that is that 2GB's audience, and I'm using that for the Ray Hadley analogy here, is already voting in a certain way. They're not going to suddenly vote green. That is not going to happen. They're already, it's preaching to the converted, but they see that as such a strong base that they end up doing stupid things like almost electing Peter Dutton to be the Prime Minister.
Further to that, I think Bill Shorten gets a bad rap by the media, and he tends to be interrogated more by the media when he's interviewed, whereas Scott Morrison tends to get off lightly. You say that national security is what the Scott Morrison government is strong on, yet he walked away from Parliament last Thursday, leaving the encryption bill in limbo. And currently, it's being reported that the boats on the northwest coast of Australia that are protecting our borders won't be running over Christmas because fuel costs too much and they're cutting back staff in the airport. I'd just like you to comment on the cutbacks, and is national security really the government's strong point if they're not actually protecting our borders as they say they are?
On the national security and the borders question, that was a Sydney Morning Herald story about the boats running out of fuel, well, budget cuts. It is so difficult for us to get any information on border security. It is so, so difficult. And that relied on the very excellent journalist having great contacts in, you know, that area, who managed to show her an email saying this is a direction that has happened. That is the only reason that we know about, which is why the encryption bill is shit, because we need to protect whistleblowers. It's a side issue. But on whether national security is the government's strength or not, it's the perception that the Liberals are stronger on national security. It's not our perception, it's the public's perception, and a lot of that is because of their narrative, because the boat arrivals under the Rudd government did get out of control. There was not a policy in place. The Liberals came along with an even harsher policy, which Labor started, and then that has been in place ever since then. And that is what people remember. They remember that switch, which is why they use it. So when we say that national security or border protection is a strength, we're not saying it like we literally believe it. It's just that is one of the issues that the Liberal Party gets told by their focus groups and their polls and all the rest of it that they are strong on. And in terms of whether Bill Shorten gets a harder go in a press conference or not, I think that's a little unfair, and of course you would expect me to say that, but we don't get a lot of time in front of these people. We get very, very little time in front of them when they're outside of Canberra as well. We don't travel with them, so we don't get to ask them questions when they're back in their electorates in Sydney or in Melbourne. So a lot of the time when either politician is being questioned on the road, it's not by the press gallery. And I'm not saying that it's harder or less hard or anything, but it's just we have a set period of time to get a lot of answers to a lot of questions. We get maybe one press conference a day, and you don't see all of those press conferences streamed live.
Rob mentioned it earlier. It's also, I mean, I don't think we should be shy away from Bill being interrogated or scrutinised, but it goes to what Rob was saying earlier, that it's a consequence of Bill and Labor not running a small target strategy. You know, they're putting a lot of stuff out there, a lot of policies, so naturally people are going to ask questions about that. So I think they get that, you know. But that's the consequence, I think, of them actually, as Amy also said earlier, you know, being effectively a sort of mini-government in opposition.
Well, it also goes back to what Ben said at all when you were talking about kids on Nauru and getting kids off Nauru being popular. Bill Shorten was thinking about that. You know, they clearly know that they can peel away even more soft Liberal voters. You know, people in Higgins and Kooyong, and they saw what happened at Wentworth, people who have traditionally voted Liberal, but, like, can't quite stomach the fact that these people have been here for 5 years, and they're, you know, a lot of them are willing to swing their vote on it. So Bill doesn't do anything without a strategy, and that was clearly his strategy. I don't know. Look, we always talk about how things were better in days gone by and how things are terrible now, but I'm sure politics has been about personality for a long, long time. I remember as a kid, you know, Mr. 79%? Bob Hawke, you know, my school teachers loving Bob Hawke because he was a great bloke, and my school teachers hating John Howard because he was evil. You know, look, yeah, well, no, some of my school teachers loved him, I must say that, sorry. They're not all lefty school teachers, especially not at my old school. But perhaps it's perceived worse because we've had such a bad run of leaders and we want to blame personality politics for it. But, you know, Bill will end up PM and he's basically got no personality. So.
Yeah. And you might not vote on, you know, leader, but a lot of people do, you know.
Yeah, and
a lot of people don't know their local member and they just go, I'm voting for Bill or
exactly.
Scott.
Exactly.
And, that is the reality. You might not vote for that. You might, you know, have a lot deeper issues and policies and know your local member. A lot of people don't care and they just rock up and they see it as a battle between those two. And ultimately, a lot of it is what people want too. Like, the one thing that always annoys me is when we write about Barnaby Joyce or something and, you know, it's not in the public interest to write about sex. Well, you all read it and you all click on it. Yeah. And we know you do. And it's the same when personality stories get up there. Everybody is interested in people and what they're doing. So you can deny it all you want. But
people love
to know people's private stories.
Love
and who's
it.
Married
love a sex
to who
scandal.
And
oh,
all
yes.
this sort of stuff. So
great.
I respect there's a big chunk out there that don't, but, God, there's a lot of people that just... All they're interested in is personality.
Yeah.
Well, what better spot to finish than on sex? I know there's a lot of criticism of the media, but can you please thank our panellists for taking the time to come and talk tonight?
That's been a summer special episode of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. A very big thank you to Rob Harris, Amy Remakis, Annika Smethurst and Bevan Shields. You can follow Rob Harris on Twitter at rharris334. Amy Remakis is at Amy Remakis, that's spelled R-E-M-E-I-K-I-S. Bevan Shields is at Bevan Shields. Annika Smethurst is at Annika Smethurst, that's A-N-N-I-K-A. S-M-E-T-H-U-R-S-T. And Ben Oquist is at Ben Oquist. You can follow the Oz Institute with an A-U-S and find me at Ebony_Bennett with a double N and double T. Listen free to Follow the Money wherever you download your favourite podcasts. Politics in the Pub is recorded live by Clayton McDonald and this episode was produced by Jennifer Macy. Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.